I'll never forget the first moment when I walked in through the cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the Scan On Podcast, your weekly look at the world of film, Irish and international. This week we had a bit of a technical hitch. We unfortunately lost half of the podcast. So what we're going to do is we're going to release as much of the podcast as we recorded. There's some interesting stuff in here, particularly Ronan's coverage of the Gaze Film Festival, and some discussion of the infamous Best Popular Film Oscar Award. So we'll be covering that, and then at the end we'll sort of join and do a bit of a sum up. I'm your host, Darren Mooney.
Jay.
Alex.
Ronan.
So we're going to talk about the usual, we're going to talk about the week in film news, the top 10, and the new releases, but let's start with what we normally do. So what have we watched since last we spoke? What have you watched, Jay?
Plenty. I had a good week, in movie terms, relatively speaking. We might as well kick off with one that Darren and myself already had a little bit of a chat about off air a couple of days ago, which is Avengers Infinity War, which I've seen.
I want to know what scenario had you watching that.
Did you see it in 4DX?
It's not no, something I can imagine you know, with all the choice out there going, I will watch this.
I'm kind of somewhat committed to the Marvel Universe in the sense that I've seen everything.
Well, this okay. is the buy-in so, like, you know, this, they
yeah,
have
yeah.
him now.
Yeah, like, I'm in. Yeah. Like, I mean, if I could take or leave most of them, but...
If he quit, he'd be giving up, like, 50 hours of his life.
Like giving up a Lost in season 6 or something.
Yeah.
This is yeah. half their audience, you know?
I gave up Lost after the first episode, but anyway. I may get back to it.
Very good idea.
But I watched Avengers War and really liked Infinity War. It's enjoyable. It's not... It's long enough, but it doesn't feel too long. Too much Guardians of the Galaxy for me, but that's just a personal thing because I find it kind of irritating.
But that's okay. They're going to fix that in the next
one. Oh, no doubt. And... The whole Thanos thing, which has kind of been kind of hinted at and whatever for X amount of films, and how terrible he looks and the memes and all that kind of stuff that's been going on for eons, I kind of weirdly like this character in this, in the sense that he just kind of, there's a sad, deadening kind of relentless stomp towards obliterating everything that has actually kind of works. It shouldn't work, and it almost doesn't, but then it kind of does.
What if Grimace were Clint Eastwood from Unforgiven? Sort of.
Yeah, maybe. It just there's a kind of inevitability about it I quite liked, and I think it worked really well.
He's resigned to it. He's not a man for like.
No, there's no grandiose speeches or anything, which and I could easily have went into that.
Yeah,
but it kind of opens with an ostentatious monologue, though.
But it's okay. It's only open. I'm talking about come throughout the film. Like, there's plenty of space for grandstanding if they'd wanted to go that way. Mm. And he didn't. I mean, the ending is interesting, and I'm not going to get into it explicitly, but, and it'll probably reset to some degree as this was supposed to be a two-part kind of thing.
It was.
Two separated films.
And then it was rebranded when they discovered that the Harry Potter movie and the Hunger Games movie didn't sell as well as they thought.
As part two.
So the part two.
A separate film.
So instead they said they'd remarket it and they'd be two separate films, which is one of the reasons I suspect that spoilers were such a big deal going into the reviews.
Oh, have they done that? I didn't realize they'd done
that. There we go. See, that's exactly what it is. Because when, for the press screening stuff, the embargoes were incredibly heavy, and the talk that we got beforehand from the representative was incredibly heavy, and it was very much... Do not discuss anything that happens in this film.
No, remember that. It's a weird
Thanos
idea.
Demands your silence.
Yeah,
and while, you know, whatever you talk about, like, fans not wanting to spoil the experience, I suspect a large part of that was down to the fact that they didn't want word getting out that this is basically a part one of something.
And it, yeah, it clearly is. So
it clearly is.
There is a narrative cheat in there, in the sense that, well, it's kind of, you have your cake and eat it. Like, we'll give you a dark ending, but... It's probably not going to...
It's not the ending.
It's not the ending.
Yeah, that's it. It's
having
like
having said that, though, it's still extremely well done. And now we get the whole memes of disappearing bits and stuff. Like, which I hadn't... I had a feeling, but I had that, you know... I wasn't aware completely. Like, but I, despite all that, despite the kind of the issues around that and the fact that they'll probably renege to some degree, in it still works, and it still works as an ending. And if you take it as a self-contained film... And add in that all the stuff that's come before, if you give a shit about any of the stuff that's come before, they do to some degree. Like, I'm kind of invested enough in it, as they say. I mean, they're not great films by and large, but they're mostly enjoyable. It's like, we've said this before, a kind of authority behind, say, you can take your Snyder kind of thing or whatever. The DC Universe is very much a Snyder thing, and if you like him, they'd probably work for you. I think he's an appalling director, and then you end up with appalling films, right? And whatever, you're never going to get that kind of authoritarian to some degree of Marvel, but what you will get generally is a solid, dependable product. And there is a product. But they know how to make films. They know exactly where they're going, what they're about, what they're doing, and it just delivers in that regard. Like, and it delivers it very well, in my opinion.
I found it very cold, clinical, removed, no real heart. It's a mechanical, it's a clockwork egg.
I disagree.
Every part of it ticks as it's designed to. None of the characters make anything resembling a choice or have any agency in the narrative, which is frustrating because, as I understand it, like the central appeal of this movie is that you have a whole bunch of characters that you've been watching for 10 years now.
Yep.
And the idea is you bring them together, they all interact. And the idea is then, logically, if you're doing that, if you have characters and you introduce them into a narrative, the idea is that the choices that they make should in some way matter. And that what they do should in some way shape or inform the narrative. Yeah. And how they're used should in some way affect how the narrative plays out. My issue with Infinity War is that it doesn't. None of the characters make anything resembling a decision. There's a point where Iron Man literally says, we're on a ship. It's got autopilot. Hmm. Should I turn autopilot off? No. Let's just see where this thing's going. And that's the movie
in
a nutshell.
That's fine. I could take that to some degree. But I think we've had the Avengers films where, you know, they come together through X to save the world now. And we've had them already. And this seems like a logical space to go into, particularly in the iteration that, like, Marvel will go in a whatever fourth phase or whatever the hell it is introduce new characters and blah. I sound really shaky on this, don't they? It's like this guy has no idea what he's talking about. This is not really my area, right?
Yeah.
But what they're planning on doing, I would imagine, and the end of this film would signpost that some degree, and the choices that are made for the film and it decided that way. And I think what you're talking about is, I would largely agree with you, except in this film, they kind of detool the kind of Thanos character to inevitably destroy that sense of agency and destroy that sense of we're the greatest team in the universe. Because clearly now, no, I'm sorry, you're not. And I actually think it's quite good that, like, in the film, they actually said, no, actually, the bad guy that spouts all the time that we're going to beat you guys never beats the guys. But in this one, to some degree, he goes, well, you know what, you're gonna lose here.
I kind of agree. The fact that they've lost agency and power and things like that kind of does play into the narrative of them finally coming up against something that they can't really do anything to stop.
And they've been quite blasé about how important and we've got a Hulk that's being used. And I think that's almost ironic now at this age because the Hulk is irrelevant and not good enough to do anything. But, and that's their secret weapon. That was our ace in the hole.
And that's grand if the curtain draws down on this and the moral of the story is absolutely nihilism.
But we don't know what it is, though, yet.
Fairly certain that the moral of this story is not going to nihilism.
Sure, that's fine.
Okay, but the second part, that's where the agency comes back.
Yeah, and I think that's fine. Like, I think that works well within the film in and of itself. And Darren, considering the amount of films you say are grand, this is astonishing that you're so down at it.
I admire the construction of it. I think, like, just technically in terms of organizational ability, this is a fantastic feat. You're right when you described it as product, but it's a meticulously and perfectly put-together product.
There's nothing wrong with product, because product in the sense of Hollywood is what you get most of the time. And if it's well-done product, you go, you get your popcorn, you enjoy it, and bish-bash-bash, you're done. And that's fine, I don't mind that.
I know, but this just felt far more clinical than usual.
But I liked it more than I have probably the last few. It's like
Black Panther to pick an example, or Ragnarok.
I enjoyed all the three of them to some degree.
Oh, okay. Which are like arguably more. They're obviously still Marvel.
I weirdly enjoyed Black Panther more, and I think there's more interesting stuff in it. But I think Infinity War might be a better film.
Okay, that's interesting.
But anyway, we'll move off that, Darren, before your blood kind of...
My blood pressure rises.
And we'll talk about the kind of wonderful thing that happens that, you know, the old idea that you sit down and watch a film and hope the next film you'll see is going to be a masterpiece and it blows you away and everything, and it almost never happens because, you know, most films are crap. Well, not most films are crap, but you know what I mean? A lot of films are crap, right?
Sturgeon's Law.
Right. I've been kind of picking that thing the last couple of years of trying to kind of watch films from filmmakers that I hadn't seen and kind of catch up on them and stuff like that. And I talked about Kelly Reichardt films for the last few weeks, right? Because I've been catching up. So I two to watch that I hadn't seen, which were Old Joy and River Grass. And River Grass is fine. I really liked it. It's a great debut. It's low stakes, kind of funny, weird, sad, kind of interesting. And it has this kind of last 15 minutes that kind of pulls the whole thing together into a kind of weird little... Oh, good Lord, that's sad and weird and funny. Yeah. But somebody takes control of their life in a very odd way. But like it's the lowest stakes and manageable for... And Ronan described her films as kind of road movies. And the two films I watched actually absolutely back that up. They're road movies that generally don't go anywhere, which is really incredible because they stopped and stymied every turn. Like, it's really, really interesting. But the film that I watched the other one and is Old Joy, which is astonishing.
Old Joy,
oh my god, it's by far her best film. I think it's the first time I've seen it. It's 73 minutes long, which
There's your four
it's
stars.
Like, it's like a mini epic that has this kind of state of the nation backdrop, generally to do with the kind of public access public radio on their car, as the, these two guys are reconnecting. They're kind of old friends. One is kind of sold out, if you will, in that he's living in a house, he has a job, he's a wife with a kid in the way, and the other guy is kind of this kind of hippie character. But so they are friends back in the day, but he's still kind of clinging on to the kind of outside of societal life. And he invites them to go camping. So they go camping for one night. And that's the plot. That's literally the plot. And they end up going to this kind of the ruins of what's kind of an old spa, I guess, the thing. And they spend the night there and come back. And it's unbelievably intense. It's regretful. It's sad. There's very much, and I imagine she's been very deliberate, this an unrequited love kind of thing in it as well. Like, I think the guy played by is Will Oldham, is it?
Mm.
Is in somewhat in love with his friend, and maybe hasn't admitted that to himself, never mind to anybody else.
Yeah.
And it is absolutely sorrowful and beautiful journey, like into, and nothing really happens, but everything changes and everything is kind of touched upon, and kind of, and just great little scenes. There's so much gold in it. Like,
it's something that Reichardt is really good at doing, and it shines here particularly. I think it comes through in almost all her films, but this is really her masterpiece. It's what isn't said, what doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's the spaces between, and people have kind of described her work as novelistic, but she's also incredibly cinematic. You
yeah.
know, the way she's very good at narratively framing her characters in certain ways to position them within larger frameworks.
And somebody shots her so
masculinity, but she does that visually too.
Yeah.
And I think especially the as you said, the road is a key thing for her.
Yeah.
She always uses the road movie structure to sort of hem her characters in
yeah.
and define them by their lack of movement.
And even in the interest that, like, they're initially when they go, and this is a perfect example of that, where they're heading up to wherever they're going, and they get lost straight away, and it's such a metaphor for their friendship, like that. It's, you know, as soon as they get together, boom, they have no idea where they're going, like, and it's just that kind of thing. And I rarely have my breath is taken away after watching a film. It was like, holy crap, I kind of wanted to just put it on again straight away.
Yeah.
And watch it again, and I will in the next few weeks, I think. But it's absolutely stunning. Stunning film.
I can't remember where in the order of her work I saw it, but I had the exact same reaction. I was
yeah.
completely taken aback by it.
Like, I've watched pretty much all the rest, bar River Grass was the last one I watched, so I've kind of almost gone backwards in it, because I think the first one I've seen of hers was Night Moves.
Mm-hmm.
And then Certain Women, and I wasn't big on Certain Women, but
yeah.
now having fallen in sync with her filmmaking, I want to go rewatch it again
yeah.
to see, because I wasn't quite there with her filmmaking, I don't think, at the time, so
yeah.
I kind of want to
yeah.
see it again to see if it works.
Certain Women
much
is
better
strange because it's sort of a structural departure in that she's got all these characters who sort of slightly intersect even
yeah.
on the periphery
yeah,
in the background.
Yeah.
And I had a similar reaction actually when I saw it. I wasn't 100% with it, although I think that final third is extraordinary.
Oh, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
But I kind of want to watch it all again
yeah.
after
yeah.
watching all of these. So,
and Old Joy is one that isn't terribly well remembered. I think people don't talk about it a lot. And
well,
that's a shame, because I think it's
I'm
going to
be talking about it.
Films,
I agree. It's one of my.
It's
I suspect it's one of the films of my century, actually,
yeah.
in
yeah.
that regard. Like, it feels there's greatness in it. And it's.
Yeah.
As I said, 73 minutes long. Like, you'll almost get 5 stars from me for that. Like, never mind anything else. It's, like, incredible. But I'll just talk one more before I finish, which was I rewatched Luck, the Stephen Wright film. And is it Stephen Wright? Stephen Knight.
Knight.
Knight. Yeah, Stephen Knight.
The creator.
Comedian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the creator of Peaky Blinders.
Yes, which I've never seen.
Oh.
But I'm not a Tom Hardy fan. I think I've made that quite clear at this stage.
You're on the
right. I do have an occasional rant about it. But this is probably his best work by some distance, and it's a really, really interesting film. It's extraordinarily well put together for such a simple it's one guy in a car for 90 minutes on a phone talking to various members of family, workers,
his mistress, and
the ghost of his dad in the back of the car who's clearly not there, but
yeah.
he's talking to him. Like,
now, when he's talking, is he dictating clearly
or mumbling?
You can hear him. It's better.
It's
he's
Welsh.
A Welsh accent.
He's doing Welsh accent.
Which actually
a strange other mask.
Better than his American accent.
Okay.
Yeah. And but the Welsh accent thing, kind of the first time I watched it, it was a little disconcerting. But on rewatch, maybe expecting it, it fits within the film pretty fine. Like,
I really, really love Locke.
And I learned a lot about concrete again, which is amazing. But
all I ask is that you learn something from that.
But it's like familial kind of destruction, and it's written large in this kind of sodium light, this orange light of the lights going by on the road.
Yeah.
Like, and it's kind of in that glare,
that's a sort of almost mythic quality in terms of like, you know, when he's talking about concrete, he's talking about concrete of character as much as actual concrete.
And there's some great stuff. There's some great voice work in it. Like Andrew Scott does great work.
As his construction buddy.
Yeah, he's running. Track. I'm running. Yeah. That's sort of like it's and Libby Coleman, I think, is
Ruth Wilson. I think Ruth Wilson is the woman with whom he had the affair.
But there's like this really nice kind of story in it, in the sense that there's. It sets beats up because of the plot points in it.
And how it's told. Like it's a high concept film.
Yeah, I don't know what it pretty much is.
It's phone booth in a car, pretty much, except it's...
Except it's good.
Okay.
Phone booth is good.
Phone booth is great.
I like phone booth.
I would have to rewatch Phone Booth. Okay.
Locke is arguably more artful for that, in part because it doesn't have Keith Sutherland with a sniper rifle in order to get the momentum going. It relies entirely on Tom Hardy. And it uses silence very well, actually. Yeah, we talked about the voice work. But it's the moments of silence where he's driving or where he's waiting, which work remarkably well.
It's really good. Like,
there's a lot of good work with his eyes too, so like looking in the rear view mirror.
And you get that reflected thing off him from the lights as well, which work really, really well. But it's really good. And just before I finish, I watched Ed Cured, which is the Irish zombie horror film, which I missed when it came out, and it's decent. It's a weird one.
It's a great concept.
Yeah, it's like the hook is fantastic and the idea is fantastic.
Which is basically there was a zombie apocalypse. It didn't quite work. We now have rounded up all the zombies and are trying to cure them. Yeah. And there are some that we can't.
And then and the ones that are returned in society.
How do you reintegrate them?
And all of their memories as well.
Yeah, that's
But I like the idea that all of the memories of what they did when you were.
Everybody else has memories of what they did as well.
But it has obviously. There's a lot of allegory here, like a lot.
Mm-hmm. Which is, but again, it's a horror movie. It's a zombie movie. No, it's not a social allegory.
But they throw a lot in. I mean, for a 90-minute film, it's ambitious. Their ambition is a little bigger than their execution to some degree, which may be budgetary, it may be running time. There's various other things, and I think Niall said that it would work well as a TV series, and I completely agree with him. Mm-hmm. I think it had more space to breathe, and it's much more interesting. Like the plot beats are a little predictable and things like that, but there's a lot to like in it. Like the cast are good. Dublin with zombies looks fun, and looks worse than the city now. It's on the great
again for the scale and the budget that it had. It's remarkable.
Yeah, no, that's good. I wouldn't put anybody off watching it. It doesn't quite execute as well as
it's a better idea than a story, if that makes sense.
But worth watching. That's me.
Right, and Alex?
Yeah. Just on The Cured, I would point eagle-eyed viewers to keep an eye out for My Brother, who played Screaming Man number 4 in the background somewhere.
If only you'd have known that.
Yeah. His second performance, aside from the time we both tried to drive to Philadelphia to be in The Dark Knight Rises and the scene where he blows up the thing that didn't fully work out at the time. But yeah, he's in The Cured.
You are, in fact, Bane, Alex.
The films I watched, the first one I watched recently enough was The 25th Hour by Spike Lee.
This was the Ed Norton one.
Yeah, it was kind of, there was a lot of talk about it because Black Klansman's coming out.
Yeah.
And I think some of the reviewers are sort of talking about 25th Hour, because I haven't seen Black Klansman yet. I've got my tickets all booked and everything. But they're talking about how it sort of looks at like white privilege and pride and power and stuff and that. And then they're sort of talking about The 25th Hour, which sort of follows, unlike a lot of other Spike Lee films, it follows essentially like 3 or 4 white guys as they navigate privilege in New York City just after 9/11. One is a drug dealer who's sort of played by Edward Norton. He's going away for 7 years. So it's kind of framed in his final day as he visits his friend and thinks about what he's going to do with his dad and his girlfriend and all these things. But it's a really fantastic New York film. And I think looking back, especially in how filmmakers reacted to 9/11, I think everyone kind of remembers that there was this sort of sudden push with blockbusters to kind of just edit out the Twin Towers completely kind of sanitize it. Whereas when in pre-production for this film, I understand that the terrorist attacks happened. But they incorporated that into the film.
They lean into it. You see it as well, the Grand Tour.
And the film actually works so much better for it. You do feel it's a city in mourning. You feel it's a city that's sort of lost a little bit swagger in the same way that the lead character, who's sort of also facing a life, or at least 7 years in prison, having gone from this sort of slick drug dealer. And the cast in particular are really good. Edward Norton's good, but I think people like Philip Seymour Hoffman's so good as this sort of like quieter friend.
Even Barry Pepper.
Barry Pepper, where did Barry Pepper go? He was so good in that. Yeah, we have to deal with Jeremy Renner when Barry Pepper could have been.
Amen, brother.
And Rosario Dawson and Brian Cox as his dad. Just really, really great New York film. And it's sort of interesting because it's got all those like Spike Lee hallmarks. It's got this sort of like racial tirade in the middle of it that's very spiky in the bathroom. Yeah. And then lots of like dolly shots and in the club, and it's really sort of stylish. But it's sort of different to a lot of his other films. It's sort of more, it's a little bit more sort of cold in some ways, mm-hmm. but it kind of works for whatever reason. But anyway, 25th Hour, I really
the ending's
really,
really interesting as well. It is. It has this weird kind of story
sort of heightened. Where you realize that nothing is quite what it seems.
Yeah.
And it's really, really interesting when it's carried out.
I like that. I mean, I saw it when it came out, and I remember the reviews were a little sniffy about it at the time because you know, Spike Lee, new New York film. There's a lot of kind of kind of lean into kind of the Twin Towers kind of thing wasn't kind of considered respectful.
Yeah.
And I suspect it's because it was a black filmmaker as well, may have been also an issue with it. But I think it stood to him, and I think you're absolutely right. I haven't seen it in a few years, but I think it's more respectful.
It's interesting now looking back, because at the time I saw it in the cinema as well, and definitely remembered it all. Anyone was talking about it, like, oh, first film kind of about 9/11. And seeing the kind of aftermath of it, and it's funny because on the DVD there was a trailer for Oliver Stone's World
with Nicolas Cage.
Exactly, yeah. And sort of
product placement.
that there weren't a whole lot of other...
The prequel.
Yeah, a whole lot of... Not a whole lot of other 9/11 films, particularly from that era, that sort of did as well or sort of got the same kind of... And it's almost as if reviewers at the time were expecting, like, oh, well, eventually we will make films about this topic and this era time and everything, but not right now. That was kind of what the feeling was about. Whereas looking back, no, this is it addresses it. It's cold. It's presented very kind of starkly. One of the characters' apartments literally overlooks it, and he just sort of overlooks the site, and he sort of shrugs it off and says, "I'm not getting a new apartment. Like the rent here is great." Yeah. So I would actually recommend it because it's especially kind of with Black Klansman coming out, which I assume will be good. And early buzz is pretty good on that one.
Yeah. Yep.
The other series of films, I'm going to count them as one, I watched in anticipation for Mission Impossible Fallout. I watched every other Mission Impossible film.
Me too.
seems to be doing the rounds at the moment. Yeah. And it's interesting. It's sort of fascinating to watch them all, because I'd seen them all. I think I saw most in the cinema, bar the first two, maybe. And it is interesting sort of seeing what works and what they kept, you know, and what like absolutely doesn't work, and the sort of misstep with the second one, which goes off on a like really jarring different tone, like really completely different.
I really like it on a rewatch.
What if Notorious was Face Off?
Yeah, it's got a lot of great action. It's just not the kind of action that
the series does.
It's sort of strange, and it's kind of interesting because I remember David Fincher was in talks for the third one and stuff, and for a while it looked like he was just going to get like a director for each one that brought his own style, and Brian De Palma.
And then he stopped that.
Yeah, paranoid 70s kind of influence. You don't know what's going on. Yeah. And then John Woo is spinning around with guns and doves, and then he kind of fell into, I think.
And I think like the other two are like, I think that the Abrams one is recognizably an Abrams film in that it's very much the mystery box. It's told non-linearly.
I think that's the last one that feels like a director's film, though.
I think Ghost Protocol feels very much like a Brad Bird film. It's got this kinetic movement in favor of story. It's got this recurring motif of like failing technology and people being asked to do impossible things. There's a really weird focus on deadlines in the fourth one, I noticed. And then the fifth one is Macquarie, which is like the writerly one. It's the one where you can tell that somebody sat down and actually kind of thought through what Mission Impossible is. Maybe a bit too much.
It's kind of interesting sort of seeing the development of what is now this great franchise with what I understand, I haven't seen it yet, is a very good latest entry. It's just...
More of that later.
I think it's like especially interesting because looking back, the sort of emphasis that they actually place on gadgets, and it clearly happened at the same time while James Bond became Daniel Craig kicking people to death in toilets. Ethan Hunt became someone who liked using screens and little gadgets and gizmos, and it's all the better for it. Like, I'm still like Lucille Bluth seeing Jean Parmesan, you know, when he takes off of the mask. Every time it would get me for one of those. Yeah. I'd be like, amazing, I actually forgot that was him. Or, so a fun, Jean fun Parmesan. Franchise. A fun franchise. And all the richer for having watched one missions 1 through 5. Looking forward to 6.
funny that like Jay was talking about the auteur-driven blockbuster and like the Zack Snyder example, which is one that you maybe...
It's an example.
From. It's an example, but I'd argue the Mission Impossible films are arguably an example of that of themselves.
I would agree, but
each of the films...
Is Tom Cruise the
auteur? Yeah.
But
that,
no,
that's how I think it becomes that. That's,
it,
for me, that's
maybe
how
it becomes that with Macquarie, because I don't think Macquarie has a strong enough voice, but I think the first four are recognizably films that are a product of their four directors.
I would, yeah. I would suggest the first two are strongly that... the case. I think it starts to dilute after two.
I think so as well. I think especially the third one, absolutely a J.J. Abrams film, but I think that was his first film as a director, and it's sort of interesting to like step into a franchise like that as a established TV director.
Yeah.
But it's very Abrams that he stepped into a franchise and kind of
fixes it.
Exactly. And knows exactly what his job is here and does it well. But
David Bordwell teaches the third film as an example of how to make a perfectly competent action movie, which I think says a lot about it.
Yeah.
It's perfectly structured.
It's so meticulously
structured. It's I really love the third one.
I think it's the best one.
The third one is my favorite as well. Yeah, I think. Yeah.
Again, I have only seen the first one.
Sorry, we were all looking at Ronan.
I mean, Christmas here. I like the first one.
First one's great.
Yeah, it is. I much prefer the first three to the following three. Much prefer.
Okay.
But that's grumpy me, so. I'm at odds pretty much with most of the world as far as I can see on rewatches. But there we go.
That was it for me, Mission Impossible and 25th Hour.
Perfect. So, Alex. So Ronan.
How could you?
You.
Pulls off a mask.
So I spent most of last week since we last talked at the Gays LGBT Film Festival in Lighthouse in Smithfield, which was its 26th year this year, which
Jeez.
Is kind of incredible.
Yeah.
It goes back to the pre-decriminalization era,
wow.
which is, you know, really impressive.
Mm.
There was a program presented there by the programmer of New York's sort of premier LGBT film fest, and that's been going for 30 years, so that just kind of gives you an idea of what achievement Gays has got.
Yeah.
It's really impressive. Good range of stuff this year. As ever, I'm complaining that there isn't enough Irish stuff, but that's more a production issue than the festivals. You know, they show what they can. There was one Irish documentary and a short program of, I think, six short films. More of that in a while. There were, a couple of highlights throughout the night. The opening film was Riot, an Australian film about the origin of the Mardi Gras parade in Sydney, which is not very good. the film, that is, not very good.
I guess that.
It's trying to represent a historical era with a lot of personal feeling and just doesn't establish its relationships very well at all. So you get the sense of historical weight not backed up with genuine character, and that always feels a little tedious to me. You know, that sort of capital I issue filmmaking. It didn't work terribly well for me, at least. One thing that did work well and which really surprised me was Mario, which is a film about soccer.
Hang on, what?
I still, to this day, the only entire match of football I have ever seen is the one they show in that Cornelio Porumboyu film.
Yeah.
Where he that film where his father was a referee in Romania and he watches it with him and like talks about the implications of sociopolitics at the time. And
how is the football?
The film is literally the entire 90 minutes as they comment over it, and I don't know. Maybe it was good.
I think it's one all
at the end.
I'm going to bring you out to watch a match.
Don't.
Yes.
Don't
yes.
you dare.
Yes.
People have tried, and I have stopped speaking to them.
I'm still going to do it. I still want to do it.
It doesn't work. Oh. We almost did. Didn't we watch the World Cup final?
You watched some of the World Cup final. You did before you ran.
Before I ran away.
You did.
Uh-oh. Get me out of here.
Let Jay have this. It's good to have goals.
I know, right?
Hey.
I can't believe you.
yes, you can.
But Mario, anyway, is a Swiss film, and billed, I don't know the truth and out of this, as the first feature film to tackle homophobia in soccer.
Long overdue, I would
say. Yeah, it has the involvement of some senior clubs, whether in Switzerland or elsewhere. I'm not too sure the details, and I don't think I'd recognize the club names even if I'd been told. But it's the story of two guys who start in a club together and work their way up through the National League. And they're on the same team and they begin a relationship and they have to remain closeted. And it's really sensitively done, I thought. Very, very impressive the way it deals with subject and, you know, isn't just stamping its feet and saying this is a really terrible thing that happens, but examining the source of it, you know, the culture of masculinity and these ingrained structures that breed these things. really, really impressed by it. And that's sort of centered on two really, really good.
It's really interesting. The area is really interesting because, like, I'm a big football fan, and this thing comes up a lot. And it was like, I mean, the FA in England did a thing where they wanted to do an ad to kind of stop kind of homophobia and stuff like that. And they struggled to get players who were reluctant to be in the ad for. And this was only a couple of years ago. This is not like 1990 something. It was two or 3 years ago.
Just to be in the ad to speak out.
And it was more about. See, but the thing, and you're absolutely right on it, gets at masculinity in the way that men who seem to do this, particularly in sports and particularly in football, it's perceived as weak. And if you're perceived as weak on a football field, then you have 20,000 people shouting at you, they're gay or whatever the thing is.
Yeah, absolutely.
That, like, I mean, just to use the old example, Graeme Le Saux, who used to play for Chelsea, was accused of being gay because, quote unquote, he read The Guardian as a footballer. And that's the kind of level, that was 15 years ago, 20 years ago, but that's the level of kind of, you know, if you're any way different, I guess, and this is schoolyard stuff, and that's what happens in sport. Generally retired sportsmen come out a lot, but generally not at the height of their fame, unfortunately.
It's the same in a number of, you know, really prominent public fields.
Oh, no, absolutely. Acting is
because it's all about projecting a certain image and being able to be seen to be or
marketable,
absolutely. Yeah. I think Mario's really, really good at sensitively tackling these things. And on top of that, a really, really good romance story.
Excellent.
There were a lot of really good shorts on the show. Gaze always does a couple of shorts programs for men's shorts, women's shorts, trans, Irish. And this year they added an animation program, which was brought over directly from that New York Film Festival, which was an absolute treat for me. There were maybe a dozen animated short films with queer themes. And they're just fantastically weird. Especially there were a number of ones that kind of looked at trans stories, and it's a really interesting way animation of representing these kind of things, you know, the idea of morphing bodies and changing self-image. Really, really sensibly done. Chromosome Sweetheart was a Japanese one about lesbians that was really particularly impressive. There were a lot of like strange gross out things. The Night Cleaner is one that really impressed me, and there were two absolutely bizarre comedies, Manavald and what's the name of the other one? Gone from me now. Hello, It's Your Mother, I think it was called. All really, really impressive, and I hope they, you know, these kids, I hope they do the rounds of broader non-special festivals, because they're absolutely really, really impressive. You know, the animation itself and the storytelling in them is great. In terms of features, standouts were Hard Paint from Brazil, which won the it won the prize at the Berlinale for the queer sidebar there. It's this story of a guy who sort of strips and paints himself with neon paint for a webcam show to make money in Brazil. It gets into the sort of social situation in Brazil, and just really, really good character study. And the absolute highlight for me was a retrospective screening of Tropical Malady, which I'd never seen.
I've never seen it.
The Pichapong Resatical film.
Never seen it.
It's really good.
Is it?
I had very high expectations for it. The only one of his I've seen is Uncle Boomy, which is actually this from 2004, I think. But this sort of foreshadows Uncle Boomy, and that a guy says at one point, "Oh, did I ever tell you about my uncle who couldn't recall his past lives?" And then 10 years later, you get
finally
that shared universe, the one that we've been waiting for.
The one we've really been waiting for. Tropical Malady is really strange because it's divided almost exactly, you know, there's a very neat cutoff point, two halves. One is a very tender gay love story in Thailand, which is this beautiful thing of gestures and, you know, people slowly revealing themselves to each other. And then there's this really interesting 30-second blank screen where, you know, people start to get a little edgy.
What's happening?
What's going on? You can feel a certain energy in the room. And then it goes much more like Uncle Boonmi, where it's this—it's one of the characters going through a jungle looking for a tiger, who is also the spirit of humanity and animalism, and it becomes highly, highly metaphorical, and yet somewhat literal too. And the two are almost entirely different films. You know, they could exist independently of each other, but they inform each other in strange ways. It's very interesting to watch with a packed cinema crowd, because it's that kind of thing when the credits come up and everyone sort of goes, huh? And this was probably a more mainstream crowd than would typically go to a Weir Selikov film, so it was good to see with them. I really liked it a lot. It's very sensitively done, and just astonishing shots of the jungle at night, and like characters lit by the moon and these strange spectral animal shapes. It's really impressive. And then apart from that, the festival is all that I've been at lately. But last night I caught a Bunuel film, The Milky Way, which is just, it's Bunuel having all the usual fun he does, just throwing stuff at Catholic Church. really having so much fun, like with depictions of Jesus and Mary and just romping around with it. But also sort of messing around with atheists and agnostics and just poking fun at everyone.
Always welcome.
Yeah, and you can see, I think you can see in most of his films, particularly here, you can see an influence that pervades cinema and sort of broader comedy culture. You know, I think it's very, very clear to me that the Monty Python people would have watched this.
So this is earlier than that, is it?
No, this is actually quite later, I think. Yeah. It's
69. Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's a huge amount of fun, but he always is.
Yes.
Yeah. One of those people who loves rocking around the place, mocking absolutely everyone.
Cool. So yeah, I had a bit of a quiet weekend film-wise.
Only watched about 20, did you?
A lazy weekend. Got hit with a bit of a migraine, so I sat down and watched whatever was on television, which was fantastic. So it was a, heat wave, middle of a heat wave, August here, unusual sunshine. So I figured, what better time than to watch one of the best Christmas movies ever made, Batman Returns, happens to be on, which is a fantastic film.
They were showing it on television? That's a weird time to show it, yeah.
But it was, Sky movies have their, you know the way they do their seasons, so they Tom Cruise HD to celebrate the release of Mission Impossible, but somehow don't have any of the Mission Impossibles on it. Much of like this, not. They had the, to celebrate the release of Justice League, they had DC movies, which seems like a losing proposition. But occasionally you end up with stuff like Batman Returns on there, which is an absolute classic of a film. It's a Tim Burton camp classic. It's amazing. The script is brilliant. It's filled with these wonderful lines like, I was their number one son, but they treated me like number two. And all these sorts of things. It opens with an infanticide almost attempted by Pee Wee Herman.
Yeah.
But it has this sort of interesting thing running through it where it's a Burton film through and through. It's undeniably a Burton film in that it's very much... And he struggled a bit with the first Batman to do a version of Batman that felt like a Burton protagonist. In that, like, the obvious thing is Michael Keaton's Batman is the least interested by those films. With Returns, he sort of seizes on this and he goes with the idea, what if, like, maybe I don't necessarily want to be doing a Batman film, I want to be doing a Burton film. So what if Batman really, really, really wants to be a Burton protagonist, but can't because he's handsome and looks like Michael Keaton? And there's this recurring motif that runs through the film where you have the freaks who are like this Danny DeVito who gets a funeral march of the penguins at one point, for example. But you have like this recurring theme that Batman is maybe just a little bit jealous of this weird deformed penguin man. In terms of like feverishly watching the news coverage, stalking him, complaining about being the only lonely Birdman in Gotham. There's a moment at the climax where like Danny DeVito jumps on him and says, "You're just jealous because I'm a real freak and you have to wear a mask." And Batman goes, "Yeah, actually, that's exactly what it is." But it's glorious. It's fantastic, and it's amazing that it even got made. Watching it, because it's so grotesque and insane.
I imagine it got made because of the massive success of Horses. So they gave him, do whatever you want. This, just give us another hit.
This is the one that famously led to those horrible, horrible Schumacher films, because it's the one where parents took their kids to see this Batman movie, which was all over the Happy Meals, and all of a sudden there's a penguin joking about like sexually molesting people and biting people's noses off and
that
drowning
seems
children.
Like horrible.
Oh yeah, and drowning.
I distinctly remember seeing that as a kid and being really grossed out.
Yeah,
and loving it.
I'm loving it. It's fantastic. You know, don't have a lot of reflective mirrors in the sewer, do they? Could be worse. My nose could be gushing blood.
Oh yeah,
he bites him. Tell me it's not the best script ever. But yeah, it's fantastic.
I have a soft spot for Batman Forever.
Yeah, so do I.
I think it's unfairly maligned
as the
because it's so close to Batman Robin, which is fairly maligned because it's terrible. But I think Batman Forever is a little better than that. It's a little smarter than that. It's not great, but it's very decent.
I actually
decent.
Dislike Forever a lot more than I dislike Robin.
What?
Really? And Robin is aware of how terrible it is. Batman Forever seems to be laboring under the impression that it could be a good film if it wanted to.
I think it is. But it's not a good film, but it's certainly not a bad film.
All right.
I like it.
Also, because it was on directly afterwards and I didn't have the energy to change the channel, Baby Driver.
Such a lawyer. You are such a lawyer, Darren. Tell the audience how many times you've seen this film.
I've seen this probably about 13 times now.
Oh, wow.
It happens to be on television a lot, and if it's on, I'm going to leave it on. It's one of those films. It's enjoyable, it's poppy, it's got a wonderful sense of movement, great soundtrack, fantastic editing, and one of my favorite bits in cinema is the moment where they play Barry White. And the moment as John Hamm turns the camera is the moment where Barry White goes, oh. And it's just beautiful. It's fantastic timing.
Two words. Kevin Spacey.
Yeah, that is a bit of a problem. But yeah. On the other hand, he does get, well, if you're watching it with that in mind, it has a very satisfying ending.
Okay.
And then finally, Lady Bird, which is still charming. It's
AKA
lovely.
The best film of 2018.
It's a lovely film, Jay.
It's the best film of 2018.
It's a lovely film. I'm trying to meet you halfway here.
All right.
But yeah, it is. It's lovely and charming. And what struck me this time, I've seen this 3 or 4 times at this point. But what struck me this time is the weird nostalgia. Because it's funny that Alex was talking about 9/11 and the way that the 25th Hour, which obviously came out immediately afterwards, sort of dealing with it. Lady Bird is interesting for many reasons, obviously because of its focus on a young coming-of-age story from an unusual perspective, the director's perspective, the experience is, you know, obviously... in Sacramento and stuff, but in terms of its setting, it's interesting because it represents a sort of a nostalgia for post 9/11 America in a way that is weird for me because I actually remember that time. It's not like the 80s or the 90s where I have a hazy recollection because I was a teenager. This is like I remember this time when I was alive.
Yeah.
You have the billboard that says never forget with 9/11 on it. You have talk about going to New York and worrying about terrorists. You have talk about how the college placements don't exist because, you know, because fewer people are going because of terrorism. You have the wonderful bit at the start where she's talking about I wish I could live through something important, which is only funny because it's happening directly after 9/11. You also have the news footage of Iraq. You have Timothée Chalamet's character.
I was going to say my favorite line when he says they've just had terrible sex and she's like found out that he wasn't a virgin.
Yeah.
And she's complaining to him and he sort of like says, God, people are dying in Iraq or something. And then she's like, two things can be sad at the same time. That's so good.
Yeah. But yeah, so it was kind of interesting for watching it this time from that perspective. Because it's weird to feel nostalgia for what is, to me, still the modern era.
I think that says more about the audience watching it. Like, I don't think, and we've had a conversation about this, I don't think that's built into the film in a way that's nostalgic in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's specifically set at a time when clearly Gerwig was coming of age, right?
Yeah.
And that's fine. And I know exactly what you're saying, and but that's inbuilt in the film for memory and time. I don't see it as nostalgia. I think nostalgia is the wrong word for it.
I think the film is more coloured by hindsight than nostalgia.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
It's for the authenticity of the story and everything.
I don't think it's nostalgia in the way we talk about nostalgia in film terms.
But I think the way that it's edited, though, because you get the inserts. It's not like those things aren't just there in the background. They're put into focus repeatedly, often without the character in frame.
Yeah, but it's taking a young girl's view of the world where something has just happened that's quite seismic, but a young person doesn't necessarily understand the potential gravity and size of everything. And I think that's a different thing, personally.
And I mean, you know, it's not just 9/11, it's also Cry Me a River and the Dave Matthews Band as well. But yeah.
And Alanis.
Yeah, and Alanis.
But
don't
it's set
Alanis.
At that
and she wrote
time,
that in
though.
10 minutes, I can believe it.
If something is set somewhere, it doesn't automatically mean anything beyond set somewhere, I would suggest.
I find it interesting that we've reached a point where we are remembering culturally period.
But this is nearly 20 years ago.
I know.
I feel really old.
Well, it's 15, but yeah, I'm feeling very,
but it's
very
like,
old.
You know, it's what?
It's 17, isn't it?
Yeah.
But this is 2002.
Yeah, but in 9/11 terms, like we're nearly 20 years past it.
I was sharing a picture of Woodward and Bernstein today. And I was
watching Nixon
about,
resign.
Yeah. And
I was
thinking about like that film and coming when it did after the actual scandal. It'd be interesting because you would have to like change things and go back a little bit, but it probably felt a lot more close at the time the film came out.
It's sort of raw. Which is very, very
strange. Very much so. Yeah.
Anyway, so that was my film watching for the weekend. But let's talk about the week in film news. It's been a very quiet week. Absolutely nothing has happened that I think anybody here will have any opinion about. Certainly nothing that people have been raging online about for 24 hours.
People
at the point that we're recording.
I actually thought you were like being serious for a minute. I said, wait, didn't
Wait, what?
So, the perhaps news that merits discussion this week is the Academy's Best Popular Film category. Well, the three changes that they made, moving the ceremony earlier in the year, which is probably a good decision, mm-hmm. keeping the telecast under 3 hours, which is controversial because it means awarding certain awards during commercial breaks and ending them into a montage at the end, which is understandably upsetting to members of technical divisions and stuff like that. Yep. You can have a discussion about that. But the most interesting / like volcanic / nuclear, you know, reaction generating decision was the announcement that they would be hosting a Best Popular Film category this year.
Hmm. Finally.
It's been
it's about time they start recognizing those popular
films.
It's been
90 years coming at this stage.
Very, very telling that I haven't seen a single person put forward a reason why this is a good thing to do.
No.
Because I don't think there is one. It's, you know, it's a sort of grab for audience, but one that sort of misunderstands the fundamentals of the Oscars itself.
Like, it TV also misunderstands the audience.
Yeah.
Like, the issue is that, like, so the Academy at the moment, the purpose of the Oscars from the point of view of the Academy, let's leave aside any arguments about, like, the artistic merits of the ceremony and whether or not Crash was really the best film of the year in question. In terms of the Academy, it's a fundraising exercise. 90% of the Academy's budget comes from advertising revenue. Mm-hmm. They have an operating... they earn about $103 million. They earn $89.4 million from that night alone in terms of selling advertising.
Jesus.
So they need people to actually watch and tune in. And what's happened is there is actually statistical evidence to back up the idea that when you nominate films that have generated large box office return, particularly when you measure that box office by bums in seats, by people who've actually seen them, sure. you do see a viewership spike. So there is, like, logically, yeah. you could see that maybe nominating popular films may be a good idea. And to a certain extent, the Academy has tried in the past 10 years, following the infamous 2008 incident, to try and find a way to incorporate popular films organically. So they expanded the category to be 10 films. Mm. Then they, after District 9 got in, they seemed to have a panic attack and said it could be up to 10 films. Then they tried to diversify the membership base by inviting a lot of young people who would star in blockbusters, like James Franco, Ellen Page, that sort of stuff, assuming that those people would want to vote for blockbusters, maybe. But young people who star in movies are quite happy to vote for movies like Lady Bird and Call Me By Your Name, which is good, because those are good films. But it does mean the Academy's ironically managed to expand from having a case of 5 films that very few people have actually seen to having between 8 and 10 films that nobody's actually seen. Last year, I think 60% of Americans had not seen a single Best Picture nominee.
And when you say Best Picture, do you mean the one about the woman having sex with the fish or yeah. the man having diarrhea in his love relationship forever? Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's a discussion that has to be had, and I think that the Academy is right that it has something that it needs to address. But this is a shocking
There are other ways of doing it.
Yeah.
You know, there is a huge, enormous international audience who will stay up. You know, I've done it every year.
Because I'm an idiot.
Where you stay up until 5, 6 o'clock in the morning watching these things. Find a way to get online ad revenue. Start doing things to address this. I know there are complexities and that ABC want exclusivity and all the rest, but This is not the way to do it.
You know, famously, this push is coming from ABC. ABC have been pushing for an award like this for the past 10 years because the rate has been going down. This year, apparently, with the infamous lowest ratings ever, Trump little tantrum thing, ABC basically leveraged into getting this award, or so the rumor goes, which is fascinating because ABC are owned by Disney, and the main beneficiary of this award is likely going to be
some Disney films.
Yeah, the company that owns 40% of the box office when they buy Fox.
It also couldn't hurt if you got people interesting to present it.
Yeah. When you say people interesting, like...
I think good.
You mean like actually host the show as opposed to individual awards?
Yeah, yeah. The awards just actors. Okay. But like, you know, somebody's good to present the show. Yeah.
Well, give me an example.
I remember seeing the thing last year where, and it was in a kind of a weird state at like 3:30 a.m. or whatever. Like, but when Tiffany Haddish and Maya Rudolph came on, and they were fantastic.
Tiffany Haddish should be good.
Yeah, like something like that, unpredicted, a little bit odd, and a little bit strange, I would be happy
to
see.
But I mean, in theory, it wasn't Chris Rock that.
Yeah, Chris Rock's fine though. I was happy enough for Chris Rock doing it.
Okay.
What's his face? I'm not a fan of that. Did last year.
Seth
MacFarlane, but
Kimmel.
One of the Jimmys.
And the other guy before it is, what's Neil Patrick Harris? Did he do it?
Yeah. But Neil Patrick Harris had form from doing the Tonys.
He had form, all right.
He's legitimately great during the Tonys. It's just the Oscars are what they are.
Thing.
Yes, they are a different thing. But yeah, it's an interesting situation for the Academy to be in.
But it cut it down to 3 hours is not a bad idea. I mean. You know,
fine, but they could do with cutting out all the stupid waffle they do.
Yeah, yeah. But that, you said a lot,
that's
like,
the stuff that's making people.
It is. It's that stupid when you cross the street to the cinema thing. Yeah. It's so excruciating.
Invite a load of people in and laugh at
them. Embarrass public and poor people. Like, yeah, it's all awful. That, get rid of all that.
Can I make a counterpoint here?
No. Well, yes. Yeah.
Okay. But honestly, this is the thing. And for all the film Twitter and inverted commas, but for all that cinephiles and people like us are arguing and raging about this, I think there is a situation where people who, in theory, like movies being a populist medium, so people like my parents or my grandparents, for example, will not have seen any of the Best Picture nominees when the Oscars are announced.
Yeah.
Because they're all in limited release. They're all shown in one cinema in New York and one cinema in LA in order to qualify. They're all indie. They're all low budget.
Not all, but most.
Most of them are. And to be honest, the odds of a large film winning are quite remote. I think that there is an argument to be made for the awards in some way moving towards embracing or re-engaging with the mainstream, because we used to live in a situation where, and I don't think Donald Clark pointed this out on Twitter, of the 11 films that, or the 10 films, because Gone with the Wind was the highest grossing film of all time twice, of the 10 films that were the highest grossing films ever, 4 of them won the Best Picture Oscar, which is quite impressive. None of them, with the exception of Titanic, have done it since 1972. And I feel like there is a disconnect there. Like, The Godfather could be both the highest grossing film of the year and the Best Picture winner of that year.
Somebody mentioned Rain Man as a kind of, was the biggest film of the year when it came out.
And I mean, and this
I
is
remember thinking, actually, Avatar versus The Hurt Locker, and obviously liking The Hurt Locker a lot. But at the time, everyone was talking about Avatar. And
I didn't particularly like either of them, so I didn't care who won.
Avatar being a bad film, people were, there was this whole thing you had to go see in 3D, and they were engaged, and so...
But that's the thing. Like, I was thinking, this year, for example, and again, this is, as somebody who thinks The Last Jedi is perfectly adequate, right?
And unfortunately, that is where the podcast cuts out. So I'm afraid you're spared my wonderful argument about The Last Jedi deserving the Best Picture nomination and the resulting nuclear explosion. But let's move on quickly and take a look at the top 10 this week. At number 10, it's Ocean's 8 in its 7th week of release. At number 9, it's Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, both predating the World Cup, having earned $1.1 million for Ocean's 8 and $3.3 million for Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. At number 8, the Gaze Film Festival and other international film festivals were placed very well, earning collectively enough to place on the list. At number 7, it's Skyscraper, starring Dwayne Johnson, having earned €632,000 to date at the Irish box office. At number 6, it's Teen Titans Go to the Movies from Warner Brothers in its first week in the list, having earned €50,000 to date. At number 5, it's Hotel Transylvania 3, A Monster Vacation from Sony, €880,000 to this point. At number 4, rounding out the children's animation in the top 10, it's Incredibles 2 by Disney. It's 4th week in the top 10, with a cumulative total of $3.3 million, which seems to be the number to watch this week. At number 3, it's Mission Impossible Fallout in its second week of release, having earned €1.2 million to date. At number 2, in its debut, it's Ant-Man and the Wasp, Disney's superhero follow-up to Infinity War, as discussed early in the podcast by Jay and myself. Opening with $401,000, it made a debut at the second spot, which means that Mamma Mia's held onto the top spot for the third week running. In its third week, it's earned €3.3 million, which is as much as The Incredibles 2 has earned in 4 weeks, and as Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom has earned in 9. It's going to be a monster, ladies and gentlemen. In terms of new releases, this week there's a whole bunch of interesting stuff on the agenda, including the Pope Francis film, directed by Wim Wenders. Unfriended, The Dark Web, the sequel to Unfriended from 2014. And perhaps the biggest release of the week, both in terms of budget and in terms of monster, The Meg, Jason Statham versus Jurassic Shark. Sadly, nowhere near as fun as that title makes it sound. But don't worry, we'll be back next week and we'll discuss these titles in a bit more depth. In the meantime, if you want to follow any of the listeners, any of the podcasters who you've heard on this episode, Alex co-hosts a podcast which is the When Irish Eyes Are Watching, which you can find by Googling it. You can also find it online on Twitter. Ronan is available at Baron Ronan, and he also writes Queer Error, the column in Sin Aaron covering queer Irish cinema. Jay can be found online at Jay Coyle, tweeting regularly about whatever happens to have gotten a rise out of him at the moment. I myself host a podcast, The 250. You can listen to us this week, where we'll be discussing Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs. Anyway, take it easy, guys. We'll be back next week, hopefully, with a completed podcast. Bye!